Avi Adoni Dodi. We enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Ga'enai va'abita nifla'ot me Torah-techa. Erev Tov. How's everybody? Everybody's well. Any thoughts, questions, comments before we start? Or we're moving into a new section, which is the practical advice about how to work with shame, how to deal with shame is more like it. And this first part that we're going to do tonight is kind of, it's a slower part, and then it's going to heat up a little bit in the following weeks. So anybody have anything they want to say, ask, comment on before we start? Okay, so then let's get into it. Share screen, dark matters of the soul. Okay. Practical tools for processing shame. This subject will be addressed in brevity, as this is not a self-help book, but a Kabbalistic analysis of a phenomenon that is universal and troublesome to the human condition. As I kind of said at the beginning, it's the Kabbalah change of shame. Its focus is not the psychology of shame, although this section of practical tools really does drop into that a bit. I mean, quite a bit. Okay, so this subject will be addressed in brevity, as this is not a self-help book, but a Kabbalistic analysis of a phenomenon that is universal and troublesome to the human condition. Yet shame, as humanity's most unwelcomed emotion, will eventually undermine everyone's quality of life if left unprocessed. This is true on a personal level as well as on a collective level. As we saw with both the Kamsa story and the corrupt spies, shame is the hidden instigator of baseless hatred, Sinat Chinam, which is the greatest obstacle to our messianic aspirations. It was really the, I said this before, but it was really the realization of that connection between Sinat Chinam and shame that was the primary motivator of writing this book. Consequently, shame must be addressed on a practical level as well. This work would be remiss if it did not share some practical suggestions about how to process shame in the most spiritually productive way possible. Yet there are no tricks or magic formulas to follow. There's no hacks. It seems that there are things we just need to go through, feel the burn, and figure out experientially what works to relieve the discomfort. The goal is to decrease its incidence, maintain loving relationships, and bring the extremities of shame and narcissism into a tempered alternation of ani and ayin. Of ani and ayin. It's also true that there's a whole continuum of vulnerability to shame that varies according to one's history of traumatic experiences, family dysfunctions, and innate sensitivities. Consequently, some people are dealing with intensely toxic and tenacious shame that requires professional intervention, perhaps even medication, and long-term therapy of one sort or another. The suggestions that follow that we're going to be discussing are relevant even to that level of shame toxicity, but they are not going to substitute for focused trauma work that is probably required under those circumstances. The shame that is addressed in the following pages is more incidental, meaning it comes in response to a specific shaming incident that triggers a kind of spasm that we discussed earlier on. It might be tapping into something more chronic, but it is generally not debilitating, though it might be extremely uncomfortable and last for a while until it is either addressed or assuaged with time. However, as we become more aware of the way shame circulates through our psyche, the more we'll notice its subtle presence behind the scenes, snaking through the disputes, discomforts, estrangements, neuroses, and rough spots of life. The more our shame image grows honest and sober, the more we'll be able to acknowledge shame's presence and not be intimidated or manipulated by it. And also, the more we'll be able to catch it in the bud, not necessarily nip it in the bud, but catch it in the bud. There are three fronts that must be considered in the effective processing of shame: an attitude change, preventative practices, and reactive practices. And so we're going to go through those three categories together. Okay. Anybody have anything they want to say about that before we continue? Okay. So the first step, we're in now attitudinal change. The first step is to change one's attitude toward shame. Most people's reflexive response to a glimmering of shame is that it's bad. It needs to be eliminated, period. Out of sight, out of mind. That's where shame belongs. The whole point of this book is to present an alternative perspective to that approach, to demonstrate that the creator of the universe went through a lot of trouble to bake shame into the raw materials out of which we're built. It's obviously served some essential purpose, and we are not going to be rid of it until we figure out what its purpose is. The Talmud is amazed by the destructive power of shame. Mean, not least of which is that it's the in the Kamsa story, it's what cause the exile, the destruction of the temple, and are continued. We're still in that same exile that was instigated by that shame fest almost that the Talmud reports. The Maharal calls shame the most powerful motivating force in the psyche. And Freud characterizes ambition as the motive to avoid shame. Apparently, a large part of what drives us to produce, accomplish, create, and succeed is our mostly unconscious effort to dodge shame. A mighty force lurks in our psyche that can and should be channeled toward good. Yet, because our ego is so threatened by it, we are mostly blind to its influence. Who knows what might be possible if we could make space in our heart to acknowledge our shame and find a way to use it for good? Although the experience of shame is awful, an enlightened response could turn things around. It could, at least theoretically, harness the explosive energies locked into shame to catalyze a catharsis of growth and quality of life. So, in this section, we're focusing on attitude. We're talking theory. We're sitting in our comfortable armchairs with no present or looming threat of shame. We're theorizing what an enlightened response to shame might look like and how shame could actually be a positive experience. It's a premise of Kabbalah. This is one of the kind of loopholes or ameliorating truths or principles that make a difference in terms of at their level of theory, make a difference in how practice evolves, unfolds. It's a premise of Kabbalah that all pleasure ultimately reduces to the absorption of some new sliver of consciousness. Consequently, even lessons learned through the school of hard knocks leave some pleasure, some oneg in their wake, because they leave consciousness in expanded or deepened consciousness in their wake. That's why, in retrospect, with enough time and distance, people often reassess their ordeals as blessings in disguise, like labor pains and the travails pass, and the precious fruits, the lessons absorbed and growth attained, are permanent sources of inner peace, a subtle and enduring form of pleasure. It is really quite remarkable how people who kind of suffered really tragedies in their childhood, in their youth, losing a parent, or and in their adult life, they actually say that if they could design their life from, you know, in retrospect, they wouldn't have left that tragedy out. They would have kept it in their story, because they the fruit of consciousness, the growth that they accomplished as a result of having to deal with that tragedy, is so precious to them that they wouldn't have it any other way. There are certain faith principles that support this attitudinal work. If one accepts the truth of them, then certain conclusions follow naturally. Two of the most relevant faith tenets are: every moment is a communication between Hashem and our soul. There is something to learn from every circumstance in our life, for it was custom tailored to facilitate the next step in our life's journey. So we are in constant communication with Hashem, and the events that we encounter in the course of our day have information for us and have teaching for us. And to know that changes the whole way we move through life and the assumptions we bring to our life. The second faith tenet is: whatever circumstance Hashem brings, visits upon us, it is always the most gentle way that could possibly be designed to bring about our next step in personal and spiritual development, given our present state of consciousness. If there was a gentler way to accomplish this necessary tikkun, God would certainly have chosen it. And what kind of God would have brought a harsher circumstance when a more gentle test could have accomplished the same thing? And I just want to, this clause of whatever circumstance Hashem visits upon us, it is always the most gentle way that could possibly be designed to bring about our next step in personal spiritual development, given our present state of consciousness. If we don't change our present state of consciousness, expand, refine, enlighten, then the efforts that we make for a different life or an improved life or progress in life are not going to bear fruit. It's and on the other hand, if we do change our evolve, clarify our present state of consciousness, then there is no way that our efforts are not going to bear fruit. So it's a very important key to understanding why, when perhaps why in certain weeks, in certain years, in certain circumstances, we seem to be putting a lot of effort into change, and it's not changing. And part of the reason for that is that we're not kind of we're working, we're not working, we're not bringing, giving enough attention to shifting our present state of consciousness. If these be true, then they must also apply to shaming incidents. They too are communiques from Hashem, here to instigate growth and deepen awareness. The most appropriate attitude, then, is at least theoretically to ask, what's when shame comes our way, what's the message? What must I do to make the best of this discomfort? What is the most spiritually productive response to this shame incursion, whether instigated from within or without? I know it's here for a good reason. Please, Hashem, help me figure this out. Anybody have anything they want to say about that? Comment about that? Kayla? There, I think I'll stop.
Hi,
Sorry.
thank you so much. I'm thinking, I'm wondering, did we cover, the background of this premise, where it's from?
Not really. No, we didn't. It's a good point you're making. I mean, I personally, I think it's
Really
sharp.
wondering that.
I think that it's like I just think I don't think I could believe in a God who brought something through a harsher means than was necessary, and that the same tikkun could have been accomplished through gentler means. I just it seemed that would seem perverse to me.
It's just like an obvious implication of the goodness of Hashem.
Right. That's what I would say. But I mean, I hear the question, and I do.
I wish there would be sources to talk about it.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, call to Avid Rachmana Letov, Avid, that's kind of right. I mean, the Tanya has some very interesting material about concealed good and revealed good, and how and yeah. Right. I mean, that's a whole story in teaching. I don't think to go into it right now, but is it the first premise or the second premise that you're
The
referring
one
to?
about it being the gentlest.
This way. Yeah, right. I mean, I do think that that's just part of the definition of being Tov. Yeah. And it says that Hashem, Imo Anochi Betzara, Hashem is with us in our suffering. I just in our hardships, yeah.
Thank you. And it like the thought that came up for me as you were reading it is that it's not just that the power of the experience is in proportion to how intense or challenging it is. Like maybe you could say that the ratio is like that. It's much more powerful and impacting than than even the intensity of the experience.
Wait, now say that again. You're saying that again. Interesting. So you're comparing
that, like, if I could say, like, it feels that awful, it must be that powerful and enlightening of an experience.
Uh-huh.
But if you go with the premise that it's the gentlest form, then maybe you can even say that it's more powerful than enlightening, and enlightening than the intensity and the challenge of the experience.
That the gentle is the more powerful and enlightening than the...
The fact that it's the gentlest form,
uh-huh.
Maybe, like, the implication of that is that when something feels so intense and awful, like, the power and the enlightenment of it is even more than the intensity and the awfulness.
Right. That makes it worth its while, kind of, you're saying. Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah. Rebecca, you have a question?
I'm wondering about, let me just get my hand down. I'll put my hand down in a second. I'm wondering about, hi, about if things haven't changed, it means we're not in the right state of consciousness. And I remember one of the commentaries with Yosef being in prison, that it says, like, when the moment was arrived for him to be out, he'd be out. Like, maybe he did his tikkun, maybe all this stuff was happening, and then circumstances needed to arrive to
mm-hmm.
match the. It's just,
mm-hmm.
I guess it feels blaming in a sense, in a way that I'm questioning that.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
That
wow.
makes sense.
Yeah, I don't mean it in a blaming way at all, but just that, like, more to explain the frustration of why, you know, things aren't shifting, and you know, it kind of, it does, there, it, we have to give attention to shifting our consciousness in order to, yeah, really enjoy the fruits of the labors of our life. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, can I go back to the text? Okay, the upside of shame, a metaphor. When focused on the distressing side of shame, we want to be rid of it, to keep it at arm's length. Yet it's also true that the tempest of emotion triggered by a shame spasm catapults us into a turmoil that is actually a basic element of a spiritual practice. To illustrate how this works, we draw upon a phenomenon from the natural world. Science identifies certain functions that comprise the very definition of life. For example, a digestive system where nutrients flow in and waste flows out, or respiration, where oxygen, O2, enters to enable certain chemical reactions and then exits as carbon dioxide, CO2. Every living organism, by definition, is an open system with inflows and outflows, like the whirlpool of a bathtub drain, where the shape stays stable, though the actual water comprising it is constantly changing. That's us. We're like the whirlpool, and there is light and food and molecules and consciousness coming in, and we're processing it inside, and we expel whatever is not useful to us. And yet our shape stays more or less the same. Might gain a few pounds here or there, but it stays basically the same. As below, so above. As the physical, so the metaphysical. There is a constant flow of consciousness moving through our system as well. Kabbalah employs the metaphor of light to describe this current of awareness. For in Kabbalah, light always equates with consciousness. Sparks are slivers of consciousness. In the course of our days, as new lights enter, lessons are integrated and delusions get shed. There is no moment that does not bring a new spark of awareness into our psyche. The problem is that this enlightening is a labor-intensive process. Just because a spark enters our visual field doesn't mean that it's now been absorbed. That takes a whole additional measure of effort. To maximize success, sparks employ a strategy adopted by plants to propagate themselves as follows. Trees produce edible fruits with indigestible seeds inside them. An animal eats the fruit, metabolizes its nutrients, and excretes the rest, including the seeds, at whatever place it finds itself at that moment. This is a win-win solution. The animal benefits from the fruit and provides transport for the plant. When it defecates, the seeds come out along with a mound of fertilizer that supports the new sprout while it struggles to take root. Sparks also come with their equivalent of nature's fertilizer. We've learned that there were seven universes created and destroyed before our own, and that the shards of these shattered worlds produce the raw materials out of which our world is built. We, citizens of the Eighth Kingdom, are built from the debris of those dazzling worlds racked by narcissism and shame. Their fallen, shattered lights, called sparks, hold the consciousness that we will absorb in the course of our days. Survival requires the continuous ingestion of sparks, no less than food and water. Yet these sparks were soiled by the corruptions of their traumatic beginning. They lie in the dark abyss of our world until the person who can raise them incarnates and evolves to the point where he or she is ready to take its lessons to heart. When we first encounter a spark, it is still laced with impurities, more or less. Yet these contaminants function as a kind of spiritual excrement that enables the spark to take firm root by, paradoxically, creating a shame spasm. In other words, upsetting us, like forcing us to just move and exert and create and make sense. It's narcissistic distress forces the ego to scramble to recover its bearings. The ego's, it's like in the school of hard knocks, like the information, if you don't have to work for it, if you don't you grab onto the light and it just an electrical current, an electrocution almost, is the information gets transmitted into the nerve net when you have to work for it, when the ego's exertion engages the nerve net, which forces the lessons to integrate there. In this way, because of its impurities and the challenges they bring, including shame spasms and all that, etc., the spark's light absorbs into the heart, bones, cells, and spaces of the person. This is called the school of hard knocks, and it remains the most surefire method of engraving lessons into the soma, lessons that actually stick. The crisis precipitated by shame is existential. It pulls the rug out from under our selfhood, which on one hand triggers the soul's survival instinct to protect our ani at all costs. Yet on the other hand, the shame itself, so it's like really the ani gets activated. Yet on the other hand, the shame itself is a counterbalancing state of ayin, a loss or rejection of self. And in the shame spasm, as we've seen, the psyche goes back and forth between inflation, deflation, inflation, deflation, in one form or another. A shame spasm is a bit schizophrenic in this way. It activates the extremities of both ayin and ani. And that practice of even in its dysfunctional instigation, but that practice of going back and forth between ayin and ani, ayin and ani, is really like a dress rehearsal, so to speak, of what we are hoping to get to when we really are able to work with the ayin ani pulse in an enlightened and rectified way. So this is its dysfunctional expression, but it still gets the muscles trained to in the pulse, which will be helpful in the future. And yet, inside that frenzy of thought of I'm terrible or I'm wonderful, the contradictions of self-assessments in a shame spasm, that frenzy of thought are the rudiments of a spiritual practice, the elements that can and will evolve into the ayin ani pulse that is the rectified expression of shame and narcissism, as we've seen or as we will see. When we know that the shame spasm is here to put us through changes and thereby assure that the message absorbs into our soul in a way that would not happen through passive means, then our aversion to shame, to the incidence of shame, will likely soften and our heart might drop some of its defenses and we might become more willing to consider the loving lesson of it all. I mean, that's a tall order, but still. Anybody have anything they want to say, comment, ask? No?
Yeah. I think, like, focusing on trying to escape the feeling of shame is, like you said, it's a tall order. It's can be so very, very difficult. Just sort of like you think you're over it and then it comes back and then it replays again. And then, the incident or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And one thing that perhaps you deal with, I didn't, get to the end of the book yet, so I don't know, but is that also considering where the perpetrator of the shame, like how did it happen, what did somebody say or do, and also considering where they're coming from, and then considering, like, is this something I need to take in or not, because
right.
Very often it's just a something to do with more to do with them than to do with you.
I mean, there is attention given to that in this section. There are, but I also realize that there is a section that needs to be written, really, which is what happens, how to deal with a situation when you are the scapegoat of someone else's shame spasm. That's a very complicated role to play, and almost more unpleasant than being in the shame spasm yourself.
Yeah, it requires a very broad vision, I
yeah
think.
yeah and so that's, I mean, something that we're gonna have to write that supplementary chapter, because it's an important one to address. Okay.
Sarah Udeet.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Sarah Weil.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. Shavuot Tov.
What happened?
I'm still not quite dropping into the first part of the School of Hard Knocks section. When we first encounter a spark, it is still laced with impurities.
Right.
And that the spark for this enable it that that spiritual excrement enables the spark to take root,
Right.
but
The spirit.
paradoxically creating a shame spasm. I can't drop into that.
Right. Like, so what it, that spiritual excrement is really just the any manner of stress and trauma that is associated with having to extract the spark from its surround, from its waste. And the waste is really that like it's the klipa that we have to wrestle with and that we have to figure out how to release ourselves from and how to just work with it in a way that will stop disturbing our inner peace. Like all that wrestling with it is really what then causes the sliver of consciousness, the spark, to actually get into our nerve net. It's like the when I was like the school of hard knocks, where you're, you know, you like it's like an electric current that just burns into your nerve net, and you have you integrate the teachings that way because you had to fight for them.
Okay, but are you saying that the kind of spiritual, the klipa aspect of the spark is what is causing the shame spasm?
Yeah, it's well, and in this particular situation, it's the narcissism and shame that got baked into the raw materials out of which we are built. So we're, you know, in that struggle, in that having to fight for this sliver of light that is essential to our next step in personal and spiritual development. So we grow through that process, and that growth enables us to is the absorption of that spark, of that sliver of light consciousness.
Okay, I'm going to need to meditate on this. Because the klipa is basically the illusion of other than
right,
Hashem,
but
right?
But it's from the narcissism and shame of this, of the Shvirat HaKelim, of the shattered worlds. And so it has that kind of element to it of shame and narcissism. Like that's kind of somehow that's, I mean, you know, I'm defining shame as the discomfort produced when the ego feels diminished or deflated. It's as general as you can get. Like ego discomfort is basically shame. And so the ego discomfort of wrestling with that, the klipa, the filth that is the fallout of the Shvirat HaKelim, that is that wrestling, that fight, that struggling to extract, and is what the work itself is, what allows us to integrate is the difference between just sitting in a class and hearing ideas just float through and float out versus making them stick and they become how you live your life, because they're integrated. And
okay.
That's really the school of hard knocks, is its specialty is that. I mean, it's recommended, and it's a very beautiful and powerful practice to learn to, learn meditatively, and learning meditatively and prayerfully will up the odds that you won't need the School of Hard Knocks, because the teachings that you are encountering, you're kind of taking them in to your heart, bones, cells, and spaces, and they are integrating in for real that way as well. And you won't need the School of Hard Knocks, but most of us don't kind of learn at that level of presence and prayerful meditative presence. And so that we need a plan B.
Thank you.
Kayla, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, thank you. Like, I've been thinking also, like, along the line of that, is that of the, of learning in that kind of internalizing way, like, I've noticed in my just inner journey that sometimes I have interactions that feel so wholesome and whole and face to face, and it feels like miraculous, and I'm holding this like desire to find a path of Shove in it. Like, how can I internalize the wisdom of that experience to grow through joy? Instead of it being like just like a, like a happy luck experience.
It seems like praying for guidance about that is and then and basically praying for the Ruach HaKodesh to guide you in that. I mean, it seems like you're set up, you're primed, like that is really kind of what Hashem is asking of you in a way. So, it just feels like it has to take that next step inside you to be able to to be translated into life and the relationships with life. Is that what you were?
Yeah, it resonates.
Yeah.
And also another thought, and then I'll be quiet, is that like when you were sharing about trying to remember, like the different ways that we can like kind of clarify the shame, I was thinking that like this learning has also been like, it's been such a powerful force for me, like just this absorbing the kedusha of Torah on this and getting this like broad perspective. It's been like an incredible force of transformation.
Thank you.
Yeah, like in a way that's like miraculous. Like I could never imagine interactions to be possible the way I've experienced.
Baruch Hashem. Sarah and Rebecca, you both had your hands up. Rebecca.
Thank you. I'm thinking about how, like, hearing shame makes me think we have to go into humility. And I think for myself and for a lot of women, the shame might mean, no, I have to go into more gevurah with somebody else. as much as I think, oh, I have to be more humble. Right? I mean, there's this toxicity going on that can produce shame, and we get stunned and paralyzed. And it might require, like, you know, like recently I was mad. I was like, well, I thought I was a nicer person than I am. And then I thought, I'm like, okay, there's work to do. And being a warrior is spiritual, you know, spiritual work is also being a warrior and having gavur and having sometimes we'll get upset and we'll have to speak out. And it's not my, like, it's not a fluffy spiritual woo-woo way to feel, but it's required.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that, like how to like, you know, like there's the Ani and the Ayin. It might be that the Ani is very strong already and needs to cultivate Ayin, and it could be the vice versa. And we're going to talk about how to sense that out. And yeah.
Thank you.
Anybody else? No. Did you have your hand up, Sara? Or go? Okay. Okay, the upside of shame, a story. What follows is a story from the Torah about a shaming incident and the ultimately positive impact it had on the one who is shamed. This ordeal of shame begins with the shame of failure and then shifts into the shame of insult when the failure becomes publicized. It's the story of Aaron's forging of the golden calf and the agonizing shame he endured from that disgraceful act illustrates the evolvement that can come from processing shame in a spiritually productive way. This ancient teaching tale offers a glimpse into why Hashem planted shame in his universe and made it a universal and inescapable part of life, and how it really is for good. Rav Tzadok HaKohen notes that Aaron, the high priest, is our role model for ahavat chinam, unconditional love, or at least positive regard for fellow human beings. Aaron was a master peacemaker, first by profession, for the high priest's whole job is to make sure that the immanent and transcendent aspects of divinity, the Shekhinah and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, are on good terms, and that there's peace between the Jewish people and Hashem. That's the point and power of the temple service. Second, as we know from commentaries, Aaron was remarkably successful at resolving marital spats and family feuds, meditating quarrels, and reconciling adversaries in the most creative ways. He was even known to lie a little if necessary. What was Aaron's secret? What made him so exceptionally suited to this work? Rav Tzadok answers these questions in a most surprising way. He asserts that it was because of the shame that Aaron carried from building the golden calf, and even more so, because his idolatrous misdeed is recorded for all time in the Torah. It is a shame that keeps on shaming. What a massive ego death Aaron endured from his public and ongoing disgrace. Rav Tzadok cites a medrash which relates how when Moshe appointed Aaron as the high priest, Aaron felt ashamed and unworthy. Shehaya Aharon Bosh, V'yarei legeshet, amar lo Moshe, lama ata bosh, lekach nivcharta. Aaron was ashamed and afraid to approach the altar when Moshe invited him to be initiated, consecrated. Moshe consoled him with the words, "Why are you ashamed? You were chosen for this job." That's a simple reading. But Rav Tzadok explains Moshe's consolation with a different emphasis, as if Moshe were saying, Bishvil ze atzmo she'ata bosh, bishvil ze nivcharta. The fact that you are ashamed, Aaron, that precisely is the trait that caused you to be chosen for this job. That precisely is what qualifies you for this job. The position of high priest requires the utmost humility, a kind of humility that paradoxically associates with one who has failed miserably, endured public shame, whose persona has shattered and heart is pained. And that, says Rav Tzadok, not only qualified Aaron for the high priesthood, but it was also the key to his peacemaking expertise. His sensitization to shame based on his own experiences enabled him to just manage the shame that comes up in conflicts and argument disagreements. The commentaries that report on Aaron's remarkable success at mediating disputes also provide a clue regarding his technique. Aaron was extremely careful not to trigger shame, not to pressure a person to cooperate or forgive or apologize or back off by shaming them into it. Rather, the opposite. He would tell each person that the other guy had initiated the reconciliation and wanted to make peace. That way, each person entered the mediation with their ego intact and secure. Aaron understood that shame hardens positions and makes people more stubborn rather than more accommodating. Shaming a person's opinion with sarcasm instead of respectfully disagreeing will inevitably produce resentment, retaliation, and obstinacy, as well as our bane of sinat chinam. Aaron's public humiliation made him sensitive to how shame circulates through a dispute and through the psyche of each party in that dispute. But there is a catch, which we all know, that not everyone becomes nobly humbled by their shame. Some get overcome by self-hate and seek relief by choosing a scapegoat and dumping their shame on it. Consequently, and paradoxically, this very same condition, the experience of shame, can be both the key to Ahavat Chinam, as modeled by Aaron, and the cause of Sinat Chinam, as modeled by Bar Kapsa. What determines the path a person takes in response to a shaming incident? This depends upon their measure of self-awareness regarding their narcissistic needs and ego defenses, which requires proactive, preventative work and reactive, mitigating circumstances. These are discussed below. But it's also interesting to note that the Bar Kamsa incident was dealing with the shame of insult, while Aaron was dealing with the shame of failure primarily. As we've seen, the former insult, the shame of insult, is more activating than the latter, than failure. In the shame of failure, the cause and the tikkun, i.e. the tshuva, are within the person's domain, whereas with the shame of insult, the cause is outside one's control, and although the victim theoretically determines their inner personal response to the assault, the offender's apology or acknowledgement of blame is outside the victim's control. It may not be forthcoming. The shame of insult is the hardest transmute, and redeem. Anybody have anything they want to say about that? No.
Could you repeat the last piece of it? What's hard to transmute when somebody does what?
Let's see.
It was the last line.
Right. Okay. Right. But it's interesting to note that the Bar Kamsa incident was dealing with a shame of insult, while our own was dealing with a shame of failure. As we've seen, the shame of insult is more activating than the shame of failure, than the latter. In the shame of failure, the cause of the shame and its fixing, which is basically tshuva, are both within the person's domain. They have control over those and can do them
Right.
privately, publicly, and whenever the timing is right for them. Whereas the shame of insult, the cause of the insulter, is outside one's control. And although the victim theoretically, can decide to react to that insult in any number of ways, and so they determine their inner personal response to the assault, but nevertheless, it's hard to let things go when you're insulted and there's been no acknowledgement of it by the insulter or no apology. Like, and you can't control that. You have to just deal with what is. And oftentimes, I don't know about most of the time, but it seems like most of the time there is no satisfactory apology when you're dealing with the shame of insult. And,
But don't we usually take that as a, like we always say, oh, that was a kapara, you know?
yeah, right.
Like
So
it's the
then,
highest form of, it's in a way a weird, in a weird twisted way, not weird twisted, God forbid that I'm insulting that, but I'm just saying it's a matana for us. It's a real gift, but it's hard to feel
well,
that as a gift because it feels so ouch, you know?
right. I mean, that's like theoretically it's a gift, but
Theoretically, it's a
people
gift, but it doesn't
are,
feel good,
yeah,
right?
and people don't relate to it as a gift. They relate to it as a shame
No,
incident.
right.
And so, yeah.
So
And
what do you propose we do when somebody does that? Because it happens a lot, right?
well, we're
When
going to
people,
talk about
it's,
that. It's not a regular chad. We're going to talk about it. There's,
yeah. I almost feel it viscerally as you're speaking about it. It's the weirdest thing. It's like it's bringing up, like my body's kind of like reacting to this. I don't know if anyone else is. I don't know why. Yes, it's just funny. That's why I'm asking, like, oh my God, what do you do for that?
I wait, someone just sent me a very interesting. All right.
I just muted because there's a little noise. Hold on.
Let's see. I can't find it. Oh, no. It's on here. I can't find it. Sorry.
Don't worry, no worry.
Yeah.
We can always post it, right?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So any last words? Anyone have anything they wanna say or ask or? Oh, here, okay. The genius of a taxi driver. This is from Leah Lurie. The genius of a taxi driver. One day I hopped in a taxi and we took off for the airport. We were driving in the right lane when suddenly a car jumped out of a parking space right in front of us. My taxi driver slammed on his brakes, skidded, and missed the other car by just inches. The driver of the other car whipped his head around and started yelling at us. The taxi driver just smiled and waved at the guy, and I mean, he was really friendly. So I asked, why did you just do that? That guy almost ruined your car and sent us to the hospital. This is when my taxi driver taught me what I now call the law of the garbage truck. He explained that many people are like garbage trucks. They run around full of garbage, full of frustration, full of anger, and full of disappointment. As their garbage piles up, they need a place to dump it, and sometimes they'll dump it on you. Don't take it personally. Instead, just smile, wave, wish them well, and move on. Don't take their garbage and spread it to other people at work, at home, or in the streets. The bottom line is that successful people do not let garbage trucks take over their day. Life is too short to wake up in the morning with regrets. So love the people who treat you right, pray for the ones who don't, and watch out for the garbage trucks. Interesting wisdom from a taxi driver.
This likely say that bracha hediot lo yakal tia kalbe necha, you know, that an ordinary person's blessings, apparently an ordinary person's wisdom, we also
right.
need to
listen.
Following
Can I ask
on.
A question?
Who's? Yeah? I didn't see who. Somebody go ahead.
I was wondering about with the situation with Moshe Rabbeinu hitting the rock, right, is another version of the story being repeated in the such profound consequences. But it wasn't insult, it was whatever. I mean, I've heard many different interpretations of what that meant, and including he said, if Am Yisrael is not, I'm going to stay in Galut with the Yidden before. But I'm just wondering, that's initiated from his behavior versus an insult, and also very, I don't know if condemning is the right word. I don't like that. But
also public, you're saying, or is that what you mean?
That it came from, not so much from insult, but from his, if he said, oh, wow, I didn't reach the level, you know, Hashem saying, hey, you got angry and hit the rock and you didn't reach the level, right? It was his behavior. I'm just wondering about your thought about that.
I don't know. I'd have to think about it. Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been, you know, I can't really keep track of the chat. So I just realized, because I just saw one come through about Yaakov and Leah. I that's what I'll do. I'll go over the chats and bring them to the next class. You know, if I have anything to say about them, bring them to the next class.
Can I ask something, please?
Yes.
Thanks. Two things. Following on what the previous person said, like in light of the two attitude changes, like whatever circumstances Hashem gives us, is it too trite when we say the power of insult to just apply it there? Like, are we saying that there's an additional step because it's relational?
Wait, so wait, no, what are you saying? Because the power of insult?
The attitudinal change it.
Yeah.
Like knowing that whatever situation is like God's giving us for our growth and in the gentlest, most, like when we apply that to the shame of insult.
That's great. I mean, it's the nature of the shame of insult that all these pretty little ways to work with it, you know, they don't work. I mean, they don't relieve the person in general from the anger of insult and the scenarios that play out in their head over and over throughout the day and throughout the week and throughout the month, that is of grudge and vengeance and all those kinds of things. So there definitely are, like the cab driver just now, like, gave beautiful a beautiful advice about how to deal with insults and not get, and not get caught up in them, swallowed up by them. But
It's almost easier when you're in a relationship, there's high expectations, and that's where it's harder to see that it's God, not the person. And it's not about them, it's about you. It's much harder to see it. Like, I feel like I just experienced something until I just was like, it's not in my control. What am I learning from this? Like, it doesn't matter. That's, of course, that attitude is not easy to live with, but it, if we truly believed it, is that where the shift happens?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
I also I missed last class, so I did a lot of review. I have a question on Ani and Ayin. Is this an appropriate place, or wait till there's a review class?
What's the time? It's kind of we're over time,
Okay, so I'll wait.
but you can say it and plant the seed, and then I'll with it when I go through the chats and stuff, I'll take that into consideration.
Okay, I was wondering if there's a parallel between the work of Ani and Ayin and the work of like bitachon and doing our avoda, like bringing Ani because I have what to contribute to the world, and then but whatever happens, that's as well, because sometimes the focus on trusting Hashem, and I feel like, well, the focus should be on I need to do more. And is that the balance?
Hishtadlut and the Hishtadlut and Bitachon, you're saying, are there parallels between Ani and Ayin? I mean, yeah, that you could say that Ayin is the Bitachon and the Ani is the Hishtadlut. Which is more an active I trying to control the. I mean, it's not a bad thing, but the I controlling the situation and inputting and whatever versus the ayin, which is more the receptive mode. It's more of a, there is a like chash and mal, ani, and ayin, like they do line up with each other. But but technically, the ani and ayin pulse is more. Is more deeper in the universe, like it's the primary, like Hashem manifesting, unmanifesting in less than a rega, in 100 times in a rega, that type of thing.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, is that Kayla? You have a hand up, or?
Yeah, I'll make it quick. Just when you were talking about Aaron and shame, I remember that a little while back I did a search on the gematria of Boish, like Beis Shin, and one of the words that came up was the remind.
The what?
The word the remind and pomegranate. And it's the exact same like boysh without the vuv. Yeah. Yeah. And it really like I've been like holding that. Yeah. Like the connection with Hoyt, with Aaron. Yeah. Yeah, wanted to share.
Thank you. Okay. So, see you next week, God willing.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank
Thank you. Thank
you.
you.
Call Susan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Blessings. Bye bye.